are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
We are the heirs of that.
Good evening and welcome to the Cudzoo Vine. This is Catherine Smith, your host for this evening. Our other usual co-hosts, Vid McLaughlin and Tim Shiflett, are not going to be with us tonight, so we're very fortunate to have Wendy Davis from Rome, Georgia. Welcome, Wendy. And Greg King from Florida.
Hi. Thank you so much, Kathy. Pleasure to be here.
Are you still with us, Wendy? Uh-oh, I think we lost Wendy. Okay, well,
nope,
we've got a lot.
I forgot to mute. Oh, my apologies. My apologies.
No
had
problem.
The mute button on.
Just want to make sure you're still with us. Well, we've got a lot of topics to cover tonight, and thank you for tuning in to the Kudzoo Vine. Later on, we're going to have Tom from Public Policy Polling calling in, but first, we wanted to talk about a few issues that have come up around the South. The first one is in Alabama. Well, I want to start out by saying that I know that they're very busy over there in Alabama. I have some friends who are working with the legislature. Some of my friends who work for Planned Parenthood have been over there all week, and they're going over again tomorrow to try to push back on some of the crazy legislation that they're trying to pass.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion.
Okay, I don't know why that happened, but here we are. But I find out that one of their legislators is really keeping busy over there. He is apparently obsessed with donating sperm and has been donating sperm for years, apparently, to donating to women in New Zealand. And he announced this week that he's leaving his family and wife in Alabama and moving to New Zealand to apply for residency so that he can stay there, donate additional sperm, and spend time with his baby. So what do you think about that, Wendy?
Wow, it's hard to – I guess I fall back on my old favorite phrase. It seems Republicans have such strong family values that they want lots of families. That's kind of our favorite Newt Gingrich saying, isn't it? I think it's a bit bewildering, but hopefully he's a very healthy fella if he's producing lots of youngins.
And Greg, what do you think?
It's interesting. The height of his narcissism is mind-boggling, but as Wendy said, you know, it's so interesting that you find with people who are far right seem to be that way, seem to be very conservative to suppress, you know, what behaviors that would get out if they were left to their, you know, to their to being free, you know, to not having the restrictions that they want to place on others. So it's very interesting, and especially that he abandoned his family, I guess, in the sense to make more families.
Yeah, that was the thing that really surprised me, that he really wanted to be with these babies that he secretly conceived, but at the expense of his wife and family in Alabama. I mean, it just seems a little bit maybe he just really likes babies. You know, some people just really like babies. Maybe he just likes to spend time with babies. Yeah, well, that would be a good idea. Well, let's move on to some really good news. Wendy, everyone's really thrilled to learn that the Democratic Party of Georgia or the Obama campaign has opened an office in Rome. Why don't you tell us about that?
Oh, well, it's our local county party, but we are, you know, any supporters of statewide candidates, or, of course, we're going to be working hard to get the president reelected in Rome, too. But we have a very strong push to get our incumbents reelected, our sheriff, our DA, clerk of the court. Coroner in Floyd County is a partisan race, and our incumbent's Democrat. And also Barbara Massey-Reese has a tough race this year, and we want to work real hard to get her elected. So Friday night we opened our campaign headquarters. We had a great kickoff event, had nearly 100 people there, which made for a packed house. And starting Monday, we're open Monday through Friday and half a day Saturday from now until the election. So.
Well, that's great. And will you be doing voter registration and other stuff like that? And because that seems to be a big concern, especially with the Obama campaign. There seems to be a lot of concern about voter registration.
Exactly. Our initial focus really is on voter registration and building our party membership and our base of volunteers before we start doing direct voter contact. We're planning to do a lot of canvassing and a lot of phone banking, trying to reach voters. Our community is like a lot of communities. Our city is a lot bluer than the county as a whole, so we have to make sure that our turnout is really high in the city of Rome of our good base Democratic voters, and then also make sure we're not bleeding out in the county, and we're reaching those Democrats out there who feel lonely and scared like they're the only ones in the neighborhood, and show them they're not, and that they can be proud to stand up and be a Democrat.
Well, that's great. I'm really happy to hear that, and if I ever get up to Rome Way, I'll stop by and help. But
please,
I'm not
please,
sure
we'll
how
have,
likely that's going to be in the next few months, but you never know. Sometimes
well, we'll
it
have
happens.
We'll have coffee on and probably Diet Cokes in the fridge, probably a few Coca-Colas too, and fresh hot popcorn. We got a popcorn machine. That's a lot of fun.
Oh, great. That's always good. You know, I always say that one way to keep and attract volunteers and anyone is to always have refreshments. It seems to be a good policy. Just even if it's just popcorn and Diet Coke, it's something for people to, you know, sort of have fellowship around. It really does work. Well,
exactly.
Now we're going to move down to Florida. And there's always a lot going on in Florida, especially in election season. But one of the things that that I heard about this week that was kind of surprising was that the law firm that Charlie Crist is now a partner in made a very sizable contribution to the Obama campaign, well, to the PAC that's supporting the Obama campaign. Greg, what can you tell us about that? And also we can continue on about any other things going on in Florida as well.
Well, it's interesting that the deeper Chris gets into this thing, the more it looks like he's moving towards being a Democrat. But, you know, of course, everyone knows that he changed his affiliation when it suited him in the senatorial race. But, you know, his law partner has always been Morgan. John Morgan has always been a huge Democratic fundraiser. And also, Chris's connection to it. But, you know, I've talked to some people in political circles, and, you know, that's he was never far from it. He was more moderate than conservative in his governorship and some of the things he's done in his political career. So, you know, it's not a surprise if he did, switch to Democrat, but it's just interesting to see that sizable donation. And it got a lot of play because John Morgan has been raising money for years, but it got a lot of play because, you know, Chris, after his failed Senate bid, he joined the firm. So with that, and he hasn't given a lot himself personally, but, you know, that's the reports out of, you know, everyone is eyes wide open because actually, you know, there was a thought, even when he switched to independent, that he may go Democrat.
Well, I think that you always think, you know, if nothing else, it's an affiliation that, you know, not necessarily his money, but, you know, there's an affiliation there, and you sort of can't help but wonder what is going on and how. I mean, for those of you who don't know, it was a $50,000 contribution, which in these days isn't as much as a lot of people seem to be able to come up with, but
it's sizable.
And
you know, there is some guilt by association there where you would you know, you could look at it and say, well, you know, that does raise eyebrows, and where could it be leading to, and, you know, and that type of thing. Very interesting. Very interesting.
And so what else have you got for us from Florida? What does it look like for the presidential campaign?
Well, the presidential campaign is actually, you know, there's a lot of actual organization, and they've been working very hard, the Obama campaign here in South Florida, and organizing for a while, actually. You know, very well-heeled machine. I think they're ready this time. And I don't think Rick Scott is helping the Romney's cause here. There's a lot of backlash for Republicans, too, in some circles because of his unpopularity. But with that, Obama still has, you know, his prominence, especially in the Democratic circles. I don't know. Now, the interesting part we'll see. The one thing that they were able to do in 2008 was get, you know, record turnout, and that will be interesting to see. And you know they put a dent because Florida actually last year passed the Voter Suppression Act, as we call it. I think it's House Bill 1355, I think, last year, which limited the early voting days, and also more importantly, it put major restrictions on who can register and how they can register. Now you have, I think, 48 hours to turn your registrations. And it's so funny because over the Martin Luther King weekend, our organization was doing registrations, and they did one on Saturday and got it in on Tuesday morning. And now the fines are $1,000 per violation, and they got a letter saying, you know, a warning letter rather than an actual letter. And so, you know, what were they to do, turn it in on Monday on the holiday when the office was closed? So they've gone that far to put a huge dent in registration numbers, which is interesting. I think it hopefully, you know, the party refocuses its efforts to motivation and mobilization more than as much as the voter registration also.
They're doing similar things like that in Georgia too. They're, you know, clamping down on the registration rules and regulations. I think it's just a, you know, sort of last-ditch effort to try to keep voter registration rolls down, because we all know that the more people who are registered, the better chances are for Democrats. Right, Wendy? Aren't we pretty confident in that?
Oh, certainly. And you'll see, I mean, the really frightening thing, I mean, as if it just weren't on his face frightening enough, because of that situation he mentioned with the limit to how long you can hold on the forms before you turn them in, the League of Women Voters, and even the Boy Scouts. I mean, you know, you know, total do-gooder, you know, these aren't partisan groups. These are people who are promoting democracy with a little D. And now they've said, we can't risk these kind of fines, so we're not going to worry with thinking about registering voters. I mean, this is... It's a ridiculous, you know, suppression of the vote, just as Greg said there. You saw the same thing in Pennsylvania. I know that's not in the South, but, you know, their elections, they just had their primary, and that's the first time their, you know, draconian voter ID bill was done. And so this week, now that they have test cases, the ACLU and supporters have filed a lawsuit trying to get that Pennsylvania voter ID bill out. And so, you know, once again, we're having to look to the courts to try to stop this infringement on voting rights.
Well, and also it's a giant distraction in the 6 months leading up to the election, which is, I think, one of the things that that the right, you know, they intentionally plan these things so that they affect our ability to focus on these things, because we have these other legal concerns to worry about, and it is really concerning. And like you said, for these nonprofit organizations that can't even they can't even risk the legal and financial concerns, you know, it's not good for democracy.
And, you know, my greatest concern is that, you know, you don't have empirical data to say that there was so much fraud going on or so many questions that you had to put in these measures. And then, too, I mean, what further supports it, you know, they have the cases going through the courts now, and it may be struck down. But what further supports is, you know, we have five Section 5 counties here in Florida and the turnout in those counties in registrations were unchanged or better in the January primary than in the other counties, the 62 counties, where you weren't allowed to, you know, where the measures did go into effect. So there's five counties that gives you a good case for being able to overturn this and say that it actually has an effect, a negative effect on voter participation.
Well, and the phrase I often hear about these voter ID bills is it's a solution in search of a problem. You know, they have not proved that, you know, Catherine, somebody's showing up there in Fulton County trying to say they're you and vote before you can get to the polls and vote. They're not showing up in Floyd County saying they're Wendy Davis. You know, it's just a sheer attempt to disenfranchise, you know, people who are overwhelmingly elderly and poor and, oh, let me guess, usually voting Democrat.
Well, and, you know, the other thing that I always think about this is that I think it says something about the voter registration. It indicates a lack of confidence in our secretaries of states and our election boards, because these kinds of problems are supposed to be solved at the point of registration. Right. So you fill out your registration form, you submit it. If there's a problem, the Secretary of State's office, if that's how you went through, or your election board, is supposed to, you know, flag it and take care of it. Instead, now we're saying, well, we can't really trust them to do it, so we're going to make it harder for you to actually vote on voting day. You see what I mean?
Exactly.
I think it's a kind of a more complicated than just not trusting voters.
It does go overboard. And in Florida, you know, you don't have, okay, you have some instances of say fraud, and as you do everywhere, but where are the numbers to support? How much of this is fraud, and how much will these changes, which are, I mean, it used to be, you know, where you did petitions, they could take a sampling. So if you had to turn in 10,000, they could sample them. Now they have to check every petition. And so now it becomes, you know, and then at the end of the day, you have to go back and say, well, how much has this helped? And you can't measure it because you didn't come in before with the, you know, with the data to say that this is what's going on, and then come back later and say, well, this is what we fixed. Really is a mess.
Yeah, it's a mess. And I don't know, you know, until we have, you know, Democratic dominance in our state legislatures in the South, we're not going to be able to solve it. I don't think.
Well,
I mean, you can talk until you're blue in the face to these Republican legislators, and trust me, I have, and they just say, well, you know, we have to make sure that you know, illegal immigrants aren't voting. Yeah, because illegal immigrants are going to risk their status by, you know, going to the polls. Right.
Right.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Wendy.
Well, I mean, one more quick thing about it, too, is part of our problem is regular folks, you know, good, honest, you know, people who believe in democracy with a little D, they don't see the problem with it, right? Because it just seems on its face, well, what's the big deal? You have to show an ID to do almost everything else. Sure, why shouldn't you show an ID to do this? Because they don't understand, they can't relate to the number of people who don't have the kind of IDs, and they're making very narrow, up in Pennsylvania, I mean, there were people trying to vote with military IDs, you know, people who could go and die for us weren't allowed to vote because their military IDs don't have an expiration date to show they're current. I mean, it's ridiculous, but regular folks, you know, good, honest Americans, they don't understand why this is a problem, and so we really have a big PR job to do to make them understand, you know, what's really going on here.
Yep. And then, you know, and add to that all these registration restrictions and, you know, shortening the early voting time and, you know, eliminating voting on Saturdays, which we had for a short time here in Georgia, which I don't think we're going to have again. All these things just limit our access to the polls and limit the access of everyone to the polls. And it's really unfortunate. Well, we're waiting for our caller, but in the meantime, what else is going on in Florida? Have you got anything else for us, Greg?
Well, actually, and you were saying about the Republican legislatures, we just finished our redistricting. And, of course, you know, we have the supermajorities. We have a Republican government, supermajorities in the House and the Senate. So, basically, whatever the Republicans say kind of sort of goes right now. You know, on paper, you know, the Democrats should get back a few of the districts. I think it's right now they're at 80-39 split in the House, and I think it's a 28-12 in the Senate. And the way it looks now, the Democrats might get about 5 or 6 seats back in the Senate and possibly another 7 or 8 at least in the House, which, you know, takes away that supermajority, which is, you know, you can be grateful for, but still, you know, the Republicans really push through their agenda like it's, you know, like a freight train coming at you. So still, you know, we still have a fight. It won't be with such impunity, you know, with this redistricting.
I'm going to interrupt you there and bring Tom Jensen on. Hey, Tom, is that you?
Yeah, good to be with you all.
Hi, Tom. It's Catherine.
Hey,
David,
Tom.
And Tim are both off tonight for a variety of reasons. So welcome, Tom Jenkins from, is that right, Tom Jenkins from Public Policy Poland. Thank you so much for coming on tonight. We really appreciate it. I've got Wendy Davis from Rome, Georgia, and Greg King from Florida on with us.
Hey, good to be with you all.
Hey, Tom Jenkins.
So what is the most important poll going on right now? What is the one that you think is most deserves our attention?
Well, we have a poll going in Iowa this weekend, which is kind of an interesting state because there's only been one poll of the general election in Iowa for all of this year. And it showed a kind of surprising result that Barack Obama was actually running about even or even behind Mitt Romney in Iowa, and that's had a major impact on sort of how electoral analysts have looked at the state. A lot of people, even though Obama won Iowa by 10 points in 2008, have been labeling it as a state that's a toss-up or one that might even lean a little towards the Republicans. And what we're finding on that Iowa poll is that Barack Obama is actually in pretty good shape there. I guess he's really improved in the last 2 or 3 months since the last time the state was polled. I think we're definitely going to have him ahead of Mitt Romney in the state by a pretty decent-sized margin. So I think that poll, when it comes out this week, will be interesting to a lot of people.
Well, that's a relief for those of us who are Democrats. I'm happy to hear that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that has a lot has to do with, I mean, I know it's sometimes how, but do you think it's a strengthening of the president's support, or is it more of a reflection on unhappiness with the with Mitt Romney as the presumed nominee?
It's definitely some of both. What we've seen in our polls, when we sort of look at where the polls are now compared to where they were 6 months ago, there's been a definite improvement in Barack Obama's approval numbers. His approval rating's up basically 4 or 5 points across the board in our polls. Usually if we do a poll now and look back at what we had in October or November, he is doing better now. But the Republican primary campaign definitely took a toll on Mitt Romney's image. One thing that made Romney such a strong candidate, and may yet still, because I think he could certainly see some recovery, is that he was pretty solid with independents in our polling through most of 2010 and 2011. And he also had a decent amount of appeal to Democrats, and those two things are really what the Republican primary campaign took a toll on. He doesn't have the same sort of crossover appeal to Democrats that he did before. He's not as strong with independents as he was before, and that's why Obama's chances for reelection now are looking a little bit better than they did 6 months ago. But obviously Mitt Romney now is in a situation where he's not going to have a bunch of people sort of training their attacks on him. And we know we're very much in a one-on-one race now, and I think it's possible that Romney's numbers will improve some over the course of the next few months.
Well, now I'd like to take a look at North Carolina, since the, you know, bright lights are going to be shining on there in a few months with the Democratic National Convention, and then there's been a lot of brouhaha, you know, sort of inside baseball in North Carolina. And then one of the races that I've been sort of looking at a little bit is the 9th congressional race. Apparently, the Republicans have 3 people running. Have you done polling on that?
We haven't pulled the 9th Congressional District primary, but there's actually about 10 Republicans running, and a lot of them are really serious candidates. You have former state senators, former sheriffs, people who serve in the state legislature currently, people who are currently or have been on the Charlotte City Council. So that's going to be a really wild race on Tuesday night that I don't think anybody really knows how it's going to turn out. There's a lot of people who could sort of end up near the top of the heap. I think my guess is that it's definitely going to head to a runoff. I don't think there's any way anybody can get to 40%. I'll actually be surprised if anybody even gets to 30% in that race, given how many strong candidates there are in it. My guess is that two out of the three runoff spots will go to Robert Pittenger, who used to be a state senator and was the Republican nominee for lieutenant governor in 2008. I think he'll be up there. Jim Pendergraf, who used to be the Mecklenburg County Sheriff, actually was a Democrat as Mecklenburg County Sheriff, switched to the Republican Party, I think is definitely going to be near the top of that heap. And then Rick Killian, a current sitting state representative who has a very strong military background. My guess is that two out of the three who move on to the runoff in June will come from that Killian, Pittenger, Pendergraf group. But there's several other really strong candidates in there, too. So you're definitely right.
So they have
a fascinating one.
They have a three-person runoff, so the top three vote-getters on Tuesday will go to the runoffs?
The top two will, and I'm saying that I think that...
Oh, I see. Okay.
That out of those...
They don't have to reach a certain percentage. It's just the top two vote-getters?
Well, it just goes to a runoff if nobody gets 40%, and I think it's a pretty safe bet with this many people in the mix that nobody will get to 40%.
Right. Anything else in North Carolina? I mean, it looks like there's a lot of races going on there, and you've been doing some
polling. Really interested in the Democratic primary there for governor.
Yeah, we have really quite a full docket coming up for our primary on Tuesday. The Democratic race for governor has been kind of interesting. The top two candidates are former Congressman Bob Etheridge and Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton. Initially, Etheridge had about a 10-point lead in the polls, and then Walter Dalton just had all the momentum in the race. He went from being down by 10, then on our next poll he was tied, then on our next poll after that, which was just last weekend, Dalton was up by 10. But now in the last week of the campaign, the race has sort of shifted back towards Etheridge. Dalton is still ahead by somewhere in sort of the 3 to 5 point range, but Dalton's not ahead by as much as he was a week ago. So that's one that could be pretty close on primary night Tuesday.
Wendy, did you have any races that you wanted to ask Tom about?
Are you feeling before we leave that race, are you feeling like it's probably headed for a runoff, or you think one of them might squeak over that 40% mark?
I think probably in the gubernatorial race somebody will get to 40%. There are four other Democratic candidates, but none of them have really picked up much support. So I think that probably one out of Dalton and Etheridge will get to 40. And that's good news for Democrats. This is going to be a very tough gubernatorial race for them in the general election. And the sooner that they just have a party nominee and can sort of just focus on the Republicans instead of focusing on each other, the better their chances are going to be.
Well, and the other thing, if you will, that occurs to me, my recollection of 4 years ago, the thing that stunned me about North Carolina was how many down-ballot statewide candidates won as Democrats, and particularly because so many of them were women. It was almost, I mean, I think except for the lieutenant governor, weren't like all the statewide Democrats who won women last go-round? Are they looking okay, or are they having any primary challenges?
The only one of the statewide women who won in 2008 who has a primary is State Treasurer Janet Cowell, and I think she's probably going to win with somewhere between 70 and 80% of the vote. This primary challenge against her hasn't ended up being all that serious, so I think that she'll be in pretty good shape.
Greg, do you have any questions for Tom about polling?
Absolutely. He did some. You all, hey, Tom, Greg King. You all did some interesting polls, and I was talking to Dave, and he might have thought that Rick Scott had gained a lot of popularity here. Well, he had, relatively to having none, some popularity. But what do you think? I know, you know, for my circles, it's more of a case of people getting over the shock of him actually winning the first time around, that they haven't really concentrated on you know, what he's, you know, trying to, you know, I mean, obviously he's, you know, we're going to try to get to the 2000, this election cycle, to really concentrate on him. But I don't see his gain in popularity as other people have seen it, other than acceptance. How do you look at that?
No, Rick Scott is still one of the most unpopular governors in the country. We find Scott's approval rating in the mid-30s. It is a bit of an improvement for him in our polling, because at one point we had his approval rating in the mid-20s, but it's still nothing to write home about. If you made a list of the 5 least popular governors in the country, Rick Scott is definitely still on that list. And one thing that was kind of funny, the last time we polled Florida, there's obviously no chance Mitt Romney would pick Rick Scott as his running mate, given how unpopular he is.
Right.
Just for fun, we asked voters in Florida if the Democratic ticket was Obama-Biden and the Republican ticket was Romney Rubio, who would you vote for? And Romney lost 6 points with Rick Scott on the ticket. He went from trailing Obama by 5 in Florida to trailing Obama by 11. So that's how radioactive Rick Scott is for Republicans.
Wow. And it's super interesting, because even if you look at it now, last week they had a major, major, major embarrassment with, he signed a bill in support of the bill saying, you know, a ban on companies that do business with Cuba. And then at the same time, like right after the press conference of the signing, he sends out a letter to businesses saying, you know, this is unenforceable, basically. And David Rivera threatened to sue him. And there was a lot, he caught a lot of flack. And, you know, of course, he got a lot of support from the Miami Republican community. So with that, I think he may be taking another major hit, because that really set some people off. Really,
yeah,
really,
yeah. He has managed to antagonize an incredible number of people in a very short period of time.
Well, speaking of Congressman Rivera, Tom, have you, when you, I think I saw something in the Post that was saying that Rubio's chances of being VP have sort of been hurt by the ethics scandal of the Rivera. I don't know that that's anything you've tested on.
Well, we haven't tested specifically on the Rivera thing, but we've done some interesting polling about Rubio, both nationally and in Florida. Obviously, a lot of people think that Romney might pick him, hoping that he would really appeal to Hispanic voters and help Republicans overcome the issues that they currently have with Hispanics. But what we found is, when we did a running mate poll on Rubio nationally, Obama led Romney 68-25 with Hispanics, just straight Obama-Romney. And then if you did Obama-Biden versus Romney-Rubio, Obama still led 68-25 with Hispanics. Rubio on the ticket didn't move any Hispanic voters at all. And it's a similar story when we've done polling in Florida. We actually found that just straight up Obama-Romney, Obama led 50-45. If you did Obama-Biden versus Romney-Rubio, Obama was up 50-43. Romney actually dropped a couple points with Rubio on the ticket. So Rubio might be a good running mate. I'm not saying that he wouldn't be. But if Republicans think that having a Hispanic on the ticket is going to solve all their problems with Hispanics instantaneously, our polling doesn't really bear that out.
And you know, it's interesting with Rubio that he gets a lot of his support, obviously, from South Florida. And I think Hispanics in South Florida have a different political ideology than a lot of other areas. So it doesn't always carry over to areas outside. Like if you go to Central Florida, you know, there'd be more Democratic Hispanic.
You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, there's
so
there's a huge divide,
and they're maniacal.
There's a huge divide in Rubio's numbers among Hispanics between Cuban and non-Cuban Hispanics in Florida. Quite popular with Cuban Hispanics, quite unpopular with non-Cuban Hispanics.
Tom, this is Catherine again. What other vice presidential potentials have you pulled on, and what are they for the Republicans, and what does it look like? You know, who's creeping to the top?
Well, the two who have pulled the best in our national polling in terms of actually helping Romney out are Chris Christie and Jeb Bush. One thing that Romney continues to struggle with is having a Republican base that's not that enthusiastic about him. And we've actually seen in some states that a decent number of Republicans are willing to think about voting for Gary Johnson as Libertarian or voting for Virgil Gute as the Constitution Party candidate because they're just not that content with Romney. But what we found in this national poll is that if you put Chris Christie on the ticket or you put Jeb Bush on the ticket, Romney's percentage of the Republican vote gets up close to 90%. Those are both folks who really could sort of enthuse the Republican base and help Romney overcome some of these problems with conservatives not really liking him that much. Of course, that is sort of what the argument for Sarah Palin was in 2008, was that she enthused the Republican base, and that didn't work out very well. But I think that Christie and Bush have sort of shown more appeal to Democrats and independents and more middle-of-the-road sorts of states than Palin had in Alaska. So those are the two strongest ones we found.
Well, and Christie and Bush have bona fides. You know, they're not – everybody knows who they are. They're not like some mystery candidate like Governor Palin was. You know, she just wasn't very well known and didn't have, you know, the kind of experience that those two have. So I think that's, you know, a little bit different. What are the chances that Jeb Bush would actually – I mean, I just can't imagine that Jeb Bush would be willing to do it.
Well,
what
yeah,
do
I
know?
No.
Yeah,
I don't know either. I think that the plus for him, if he did it, was that if he did it and Romney lost and Jeb Bush wants to be president, I think that would instantaneously put Bush at the top of the presidential list for Republicans in 2016. I think he's already pretty close to the top of the list for Republicans in 2016 anyway, but being willing to serve as the vice presidential nominee this year, I think, would help him with that even more.
I don't know. He better be worried. I think Newt wants to be vice president.
Have you run numbers on the other the other candidates, like Romney Gingrich or Romney Santorum, or you know, what do those numbers look like?
If you do Romney Santorum, it basically changes. It doesn't change the numbers at all. Santorum helps with certain elements of the Republican base, but he also turns off some independents and more conservative Democrats in a way that Christie or Bush does not. Gingrich actually really hurts Romney. Romney went from trailing Obama by 3 points nationally to trailing by 6. Newt kind of turns off a lot of voters without bringing anybody else into the equation. And even though I think this is pretty far-fetched, we also tested Ron Paul, and he goes from Obama being up by 3, then to, with Paul on the ticket, Obama being up by 5. Paul does have some appeal to independents in a way that no other running mate would, but there's a flip side to that, which is that a lot of Republicans would not be willing to vote for a ticket with Ron Paul on it because they just think he's crazy. So as an overall thing, Paul wouldn't be helpful.
Tom, do you... I have to admit that, you know, I'm not, you've heard me say this before, I'm not a big poll watcher. I my personal feeling, sometimes I think that we spend a lot of time looking at polls and they change so much. But, I have a lot of respect for the work. It's just that it's not one of my things. Do you do a lot of polling on women? Like, how does it look for the president and for Mitt Romney just with women?
Well, the whole outcome of this war on women thing really comes through in our polling. Obama's leading Romney by about 15 points with women nationally. And then a lot of time when we go into individual swing states, Obama's up by 10, 15, sometimes even 20 points with women. Definitely, I think the Republican Party's image with women has really taken a hit over the last 6 months. Republicans need this election to be about the economy, because most Americans still aren't feeling that optimistic about the economy. And a lot of the time you sort of say, well, you know, we gave Obama 4 years to fix it. He didn't fix it. So now we're going to vote for somebody else. But Republicans have, I think, erred a little bit over the last really year and a half since they got control of the House in focusing too much on social issues that often turn off people in the center, and particularly independent women. I think that Democrats have really gained back some of the ground that they lost in 2009 and 2010 with independent women, because once the Republicans got some control, a lot of women just think that the agenda is too extremist, especially on social issues and on women's issues in particular. So that's something to really keep an eye on. If Obama can maintain this 15-point lead that he has with women nationally all the way through November, definitely going to get reelected. Republicans can't overcome that.
Yeah, because there's more women voters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, given
ahead,
that,
Wendy,
too,
have you,
no, that's all right. Have you tested any potential women VPs on the Republican side? I mean, I'm guessing maybe Palin, although I think that, you know, is as much of a strut as Gingrich at this point, but.
Yeah, Palin's the only one we've tested nationally, and unsurprisingly, she would have the worst impact on Romney's ticket of anybody. She costs him 4 points. He goes from trailing Obama by 3 to trailing Obama by 7. One who we've tested on at the state level is New Mexico Governor Susana Martinez, who's one of the most popular governors in the country. Really impressive that a Republican governor in a pretty Democratic state has the numbers that Martinez does. She's definitely a rising star. She helps Romney a little bit in New Mexico. If you put her on the ticket, Romney goes from trailing by 14 to only trailing by 11. So she helps, but it's definitely not the kind of thing where she would actually flip the state. And she said that because of some family obligations that she's not interested in doing it anyway.
Why? Well, I'm
yeah,
just hoping
it seems
that
like...
they... Go ahead.
Go ahead, Wendy.
I'm just hoping that whoever's in charge of the vetting does as poor a job this fall as they did 4 years ago.
Absolutely.
We all watched Game Change, right? Well, Greg, do you have any more questions about polling for Tom? Greg. Okay. Are there any other races? I know Virginia is going to be really hot, both in 2012 and in 2014, it looks like. What are your thoughts about that, Tom?
Well, I think Obama's looking really good in Virginia. We did a poll, and also the Washington Post did a poll this week in Virginia. And between the two polls, we found Obama up by either 7 or 8 points on Romney in Virginia, pretty similar to his 6-point margin of victory in 2008. So Obama's holding up pretty well there, really impressive. What's interesting is that the Senate race is actually still very close, even though Obama's ahead. We see a 1-point margin in the Senate race, with Tim Kaine only up a point on George Allen. A lot of people sort of ask me, who are these Allen Obama voters? And I don't know. It's surprising that they exist. But George Allen's popularity in Virginia is a lot better than Mitt Romney's, and that's why Allen is so much more competitive than Romney is at this point. So I think Obama's probably going to win Virginia unless there's a big shift in the picture nationally between now and November. And that's huge for him, because obviously it's very hard for Republicans to get to 270 electoral votes without Virginia. So that's kind of the 2012 picture. And then Virginia also, you know, the nice thing about Virginia is there's a big election every year because they do their state stuff in the odd years. So we also, when we were polling Virginia last week, took a look ahead to next year's race for governor. Things are pretty clear on the Republican side that it's going to be a primary contest between Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli and Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling. Cuccinelli right now, who's sort of a national darling of conservatives, has a huge lead in that primary. It looks like certainly at least at this point, a year away from the primary, Cuccinelli is the strong favorite. Things have been slower to develop on the Democratic side. There's some thought that Senator Mark Warner might want to run and reclaim his old position as governor. In Virginia, you're allowed to serve more than one term as governor, but you're not allowed to serve consecutively. So Warner would be trying to return to that office after 8 years out. And what we found is that Warner would just completely stomp anybody on the Republican side. He leads by about 20 points Warner's easily the most popular politician in Virginia. So if he runs, he'd be a strong favorite. If he doesn't, some of the Democrats who have been talked about the most, former DNC chair Terry McAuliffe, who also ran in 2009, and former Congressman Tom Perriello, who won an amazing upset to get elected the House in 2008, couldn't quite hold on in the 2010 wave. Either of them would start out in about a toss-up with either of the Republicans. So that race sort of looks 50-50, unless Mark Warner runs, and then Democrats have a strong advantage.
Well, that sounds great. I'm thrilled to hear those numbers for President Obama in Virginia. Well, Tom, thank you so much for being on. Do you have any last things that you'd like to mention, or what did we miss?
Well, in closing, I'd just say, any time up until about the turn of the year, if you asked me what I thought Obama's chances for reelection were, I would have told you over and over again, it's 50-50, it's 50-50, it's 50-50. The Republican primary process really did take enough of a toll on Romney's image and the image of the GOP as a whole that I now think Obama's chances of reelection are about 60%. I think some people would put it a lot higher than that. I think people should be careful about getting overly optimistic. I think that inevitably there are going to be some bumps in the road for Obama between now and November, but definitely think without a shadow of a doubt that he's in a better position now than he was 6 months ago.
Well, thank you very much. And why don't you take a minute to explain to people how they can contact you? And, I know you're on Facebook and Twitter and on the web, so if you want to fill everybody in on that, that might be helpful if people want to take a look at your polls.
Sure. We release polls almost every day, and the best place to see those is our website, which is publicpolicypolling.com. And then we also use our Twitter feed not just to release the results of polls that we've completed, but we'll also often tell you how a poll's going that we're currently running, which is something we do that's a little different from most polling companies. And our Twitter got a lot of P's in it. It's PP polls. So that 4 P's and then polls, OLLS, is our Twitter.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being on tonight. We really appreciate your comments. Always welcome you to come on again. Thank you very much, Tom Jensen.
Okay, thanks, y'all. Have a great night.
You too. Bye. Okay, Wendy and Greg, we've got just a few more minutes, about 13 minutes. We want to, if there's anything, there's some things that we talked about, that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet. One of the things that I found interesting was in South Carolina, there has been a little bit of a shift in some of the candidates that were running as against incumbents have been knocked off the rolls because of not completing some of the qualification forms. Wendy, I think you're a little bit more informed about this than I am, if you want to talk about it.
Sure. It's statewide, there are about 1,000 candidates who had qualified for all the elections, local elections, legislative posts and such. And about a fifth of those, 180 candidates this week were struck from the ballot. And I think a little sadly, they're all challengers, which, says something about the deck being stacked against them. But it seems that the powers that be, who are supposed to help people get all their ducks in a row before qualifying, didn't make it clear that these folks had to fill out one of those ethics forms that says where your personal money comes from, and so 180 people who wanted to offer themselves up from office now when it's too late to fix it are taken off the ballot, and I think that's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, and it actually cut down, like, there's something like quite a number of candidate incumbents who had potential challengers who have no challenger now,
right.
Mostly in the Lexington and Richland area. But, it's kind of shocking. We always think that, it's an election. Give people an opportunity to, make a choice. It's part of our democratic values, at least it is to me. And it's unfortunate that either whatever happened, whether the rules weren't clarified or if there's some, you know, wink, wink, you don't really don't have to do that, and then they decided to stick to it. So it's unfortunate. Greg, what are your thoughts about this? Did we lose Greg? I wonder if we lost Greg.
Or he might have just done what I did and not figured out how to mute himself.
There,
Hello?
I think you got muted. Hello, Greg. I'm sorry. I think you got muted somehow.
Hey, Kathy?
Yes, this is Kathy.
Hi, Kathy? Okay, I'm back. And you know, it's so funny. I've been muted for so long, and I had a question for Tom about the Florida Senate race.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know how you got muted. I'm so sorry.
I felt like the serpent in the rainbow. Like I'm sitting here and can't talk like the serpent in the rainbow, but that's okay. But I'm sorry. It's very interesting that those people were disqualified. And you know, being a campaign manager, it's frustrating also because you know, going through the process, you know, there should be at least some way to. If it's a clerical or administrative issue, to rectify it so you can be on the ballot, you know, and as you're saying, and it's hard for, you know, a secretary of state or a supervisor of elections to say against an incumbent, you know, I'm going to put you back on the ballot, especially if the person's way down, because then, you know the other person's going to win. And if they want to just go in, I mean, you know, it will look real bad on yourself to say, well, let me, you know, put them back on the ballot just to give you the headache, even though it's their right to run. You know, they have the right to run as much as anyone.
Yeah, and it seems, I agree. It seems like if you're, you know, here in Georgia, we qualify our candidates to come in to an office either in their county or at the state level, and they fill out all their paperwork, and it goes through a process to be approved. And if it's not complete, then they're informed that it's not complete, and they have to, you know, fill out this form or whatever. So for them to, you know, sort of ignore I don't know exactly what happened. I mean, it would be interesting to find out how this happened, whether it was, you know, by omission or by commission.
That's the same thing with the voter suppression. I mean, there's a way where you can be reactive or proactive, and they've taken a reactive approach to just saying it's wrong and you're out, and that's not fair, and it's not. You know, if this was something that everybody did every day, like, say, a driver's license test or something like that you should know, you'd understand. But this is, you know, running for office. Not everybody's done it before. Not everybody is familiar with it. Help them through the process or, you know, and that's the way it should.
Or say you missed the deadline, here's a hefty fine, you know, and let the people decide if their error was a clerical error or if they were trying to hide assets they thought that would damage them publicly. Obviously, if it's 180 people this happened to, I don't think this is, you know, a candidate trying to duck that they're really – you know, have poor houses and don't want to tell anybody.
Yeah,
exactly.
With that kind of numbers, you have to think that there is some problem in the process, whether it's, you know, there should be a fine or whatever the solution might be. It seems like it's a problem.
It's so interesting that things like that are happening because it takes you back to a time where people wanted to discourage people from even being involved in the electoral process. So it's real concerning now. That's going on.
Well, you know, I've said for years that elected officials really, when it comes right down to it, Democrats or Republicans, with, you know, a lot of exceptions, they kind of like to have their voting population known, right? So they know that if they're a Republican, they know that they can count on X percent of Republicans to vote for them. They can count on X percent of the Democrats in their district not to vote for them, and so they really only have to fight for that middle section of independents or swing voters. But if you start adding a lot of people to those roles, if you start doing a lot of voter registration in areas where there aren't a lot of lower registration levels, then those candidates, those especially incumbents, are like, wait a minute, you mean I have to like figure out what they want now?
And then
they also have to represent them. I mean, they don't just have to count on them for votes, but they have to actually represent them if they do get elected. And I think there's a long history of that kind of attitude in this country, certainly in the South. I think it's nationwide, but I think there's a lot more of it in the South. And I don't know how you overcome that without a lot of activism from outside the party, I think. I mean, some of it can come from inside the party, but you know, as when party people are devoted to their incumbents as well.
Right, and I am, you know, it comes down to, especially from a Democratic perspective, is mobilization. You have a healthy role, especially in Florida, where Democrats actually outnumber Republicans, and we have several districts where we outnumber them. But, you know, because of organization and mobilization, you know, we you know, you get run around in circles. So that's a big part of it, getting those people who are less motivated to the poll.
Yes. You have to figure out a way to motivate them. And sometimes they feel like they're you know, they feel completely out of the loop because they haven't had representation, good representation,
right,
for so long. So, yeah, that's the challenge,
right,
for all of us,
you.
Right? Okay, Wendy, you had an interesting story coming out of Tennessee. We've got about 5 minutes. I think that's just about right.
Yeah, I was hoping we wouldn't miss the opportunity to look at our quote-unquote conservative friends, our neighbors up in Tennessee here, Catherine. You know, they're always talking about how they want less government until they decide that government needs to do something else, and they always talk about how they want our teachers to just focus on, what is it, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Well, now they have decided in Tennessee that they need to stop gateway sexual activity, right? And what they consider the gateway to sexual activity is hand-holding and hugging and kissing in schools. So now teachers, in addition to all the other obligations they have and the things they're trained to do, now teachers can be held accountable if their students are holding hands or hugging or kissing, I guess, in the classrooms or the hallway. That's not exactly clear, and it's pretty darn ridiculous, if you ask me.
And we know that if teenagers are stopped from kissing and hugging and holding hands in school, that will stop them from doing it anywhere else, right?
Exactly. Basically, we don't want to condone this activity, right? Because it just takes them down a dark path that we don't want them going down until they get married.
Right, and we can't put any expectations on their parents to
That's a big part of it. I think they've taken, and I think a lot of parents like some of the measures that they're doing for education, because it takes responsibility off of them to be responsible, actually responsible, for raising their children. And that's a big part of it. We have to take personal responsibility for what our children do. And you can't legislate morality or ethics. It has to be, you know, taught from a, you know, family level. You can't expect them to do that. They have enough problems.
I always say that when I was a child, my education began long before I started going to school, and it continued long after I was, you know, dismissed from school, either during the school year or even for the summer. And my parents I mean, I was fortunate that they took a big – they recognized that it was their responsibility to not only continue my education, but also to show me, like, that I'm supposed to walk on the right side of the sidewalk and go through the right-hand door, and because that's the way society works best, as if we're all kind of organized in that way. And I think we put all that on teachers now. It seems like to me. I mean, I don't have children, but it sure seems like we put a lot of pressure – on teacher. I have a friend who's a teacher, and she used to tell me that the kids would come in, they hadn't had any breakfast, they didn't have any money or lunch, they hadn't taken a bath, and, you know, how can you expect a child to learn when they have no food, they're not eating? You know, there's all these dynamics that affect education that, and I mean, a lot of it has to do with poverty, and I don't know, and that's a whole other question. But it's a big conundrum for this country, and I think we short sell our children every day because of it.
Absolutely.
Well, and also, I mean, just one last point too is, you know, although I know most of us held hands and hugged someone and kissed them before. Considering other sexual activities, but frankly, you know, all hand-holding hugs and kisses aren't per se sexual in nature, you know? I mean, and I'm thinking of, you know, school kids, you know, who routinely, you know, greet each other with a hug, right? And it and it's a warmth thing. And we have we have so much ugliness and meanness in our society, and you know, we could go on and on about how the internet, you know, perpetuates that, but the, you know, the physical touch of bringing people together, I don't think is evil by nature. And I think, you know, ridiculous laws like this just take us further down that, you know, what we, I think they're heading for the 1850s. I think they're just heading for the 1850s.
Well, on that note, we are actually already over time. We're into recording now. Thank you both so much for being on with us. Wendy Davis from Rome, Georgia, and Greg King from Florida. Thanks so much for being on.
Absolutely.
And tune in next week to Blog Talk Radio. Cut to Vine.
Thanks,
thank you very much. Good night.
All right. Bye-bye.